Well, last night we began our retreat by going out into the desert. And I think this desert experience is going to continue throughout the weekend, especially at the beginning. You're in an unfamiliar place and everything is on a giant scale to get from point A to point B, and you're trying to figure out what is the rhythm of the herd. You hear the herd going by and whatnot. But as time goes on, I think we'll settle in and kind of understand, okay, this is where I sleep, this is where this takes place, this is where the other things are, and kind of get the rhythm down. And that helps create the desert space, the space of silence where we can kind of let everything else, let all the distractions in a sense dissipate, and we focus on what is essential. Now, if you guys have done spiritual exercises before, you all have. Somebody here has done them 25 times, so there you go. In the exercises, we always begin by going back to the beginning, back to creation, back to the Garden of Eden. And we're going to spend a long time there today. Frankly, we're going to spend the entire day just dealing with the first part of the exercises, because there's so many ramifications that come from creation. You know, it's interesting when the scribes and Pharisees asked Jesus the question about divorce, he didn't give them a big treatise. He said, what was it like in the beginning? What do you read there? So the point of reference is always the beginning, because that was God's original plan. And realistically, what he's done since then is restoration and kind of returning to the original plan and improving upon it, really, because the coming of the fact that God himself would become incarnate was not part of plan A. There's a little bit of argument there. I actually think probably it was part of plan A eventually, but that's pure speculation and it really is not essential to our discourse here. You'll notice at the very top of your notes, there's a word that says live. It doesn't say live, it says live. When I was kicking around ideas, I remembered Stephen Covey. You remember? Tip of the hat. Make a reverence every time the name is mentioned. Stephen Covey. I remember him saying there are four fundamental drives that we all have, right? One is to live, to love, to learn, and to leave a legacy. To learn, I think we can probably another, I mean, it's not an L word, which is probably why he didn't choose it. I would say to grow, perhaps, would be what he was getting at. Not just to learn new and exciting things, but to grow, ultimately, intellectually, and to become a richer, more experienced, richer person. And I was trying to make those four words fit somewhere, so I decided live would be the best place to put this one. So that's, you'll see those little catchwords at the top of some of the meditations. So right now we're going to back to the Garden of Eden, and you have the reading from Genesis. Then God said, let us make human beings in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the tame animals, all the wild animals, the creatures that crawl on the earth. God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and all the other stuff. Okay. There are two things that jump out repeatedly in that little section from Genesis that I read. Repeatedly, you will see reference to the fact that we are made in God's image and likeness. And repeatedly, you'll see that God has given Adam and Eve dominion. He's given, how many word times does it pop out there? Dominion over the fish of the sea. Subdue the earth, that's dominion. Have dominion over the fish of the sea again. And then he says he's given everything around basically for food. which also implies a certain kind of a dominion. So in God's mind, clearly, being made in his image and likeness, one of the, either part of that, something essential to that, is the fact that he has given us a different kind of dominion. He's given us an authority that no other creature has. And he goes to great lengths in the God, in the Bible, rather, in Genesis, to say, to spell out that we are different than everything else that has been made. He goes through this long scientific kind of analysis of creation from light and darkness and the creation of the vegetation and all that. And he's got this long, drawn-out description of it. And then when we come along, there's a difference. We're not just one more thing. We actually become the pinnacle of everything that he has established. I don't think... Well, I think this is something that we can misunderstand a lot. You know, since the fall, we have lost really a lot of our understanding of what it means to be in a relationship with God. Adam and Eve, like the Blessed Virgin Mary, like Jesus, had this innate, intuitive knowledge and experience of God that none of us, well, we're not really ever going to have it this side of heaven. We will tend towards it. If we grow in holiness, we will trend in that direction. I don't know, maybe perhaps the great saints, perhaps the Padre Pios and some of those people do, you know, maybe they actually excel in love what Adam and Eve achieved during their years on earth. I don't know. But it's always, there's always going to be something different about the experience that you and I have of God and the experience, our understanding as beings in the world and what they had in their original innocence. And actually this whole idea of dominion is something that in my own journey the last year or so has been coming up more and more. And again, a dominion properly understood, because it doesn't mean that we're tyrants, right? It doesn't mean that we are... God has given you just free rein to kind of go around and terrorize the world. It's far from it. So what do we mean when we talk about having dominion? Well, first of all, I think is in the very simple sense that when God made us in his image and likeness, he gave us an intellect and a will, right? There's actually a distinction that theologians make between image and likeness. And if you go to the catechism, you'll actually see it in there. The fact that he made us in his image means that he made us, as it would say in Latin, capax Dei, which means capable of himself. He made us with an intellect and a will. We are spiritual beings, and therefore we are capable of entering into a relationship of God, with God. And that intellect that he's given us allows us to explore the world, to discover things, and he gave it to us to a great extent so that in exploring the world and working with the world and living our lives in the world, we would constantly encounter his reflections in creation, the vastness of the cosmos, which Adam and Eve didn't get how big the cosmos were, but they did get the fact that, you know, if you're standing on a cliff looking out over the horizons, that's really big and you feel really small. And as we continue to discover more and more things, though, the entire created universe is this book that is talking about, that's giving us images of different elements of God. If you look in nature and you'll see, I don't know, the tenderness of a mother bird, you know, with the little newly hatched little chicks and she's taken care of. Well, there's an image of the love and the tenderness that God has. The beauty and the warmth of a sunset, for example, the majesty of the roaring seas and the starry skies and all of these different things are images of dimensions of God. And they are meant to, if we are sensitive souls, then simply by kind of being out in nature, we will see traces of God's fingerprints. And the same thing, obviously, to a greater extent in our human relationships. There is... no greater natural image, if you want, of God in the universe than other human beings. the love of, again, of your, that you have for your wife, that is a love, is a participation in God's own being, in God's own love. And when you see the interactions of little kids and whatnot, and the innocence, and all of these things point towards God the Creator and what His plan is for us. So the first thing is, the first way that we have dominion is simply the fact that we are the only creatures endowed with intellect that are out there. We're the only creatures that know, that are able to, you know, explore and take things apart and put them together and beautify creation and perfect creation. You know, there's a kind of a strain of thought out there that we are just one more creature in the cosmos, and we, as long as we just don't overstep our bounds, we'll be fine. But you know, the problem with human beings is we're always overstepping our bounds and making it about ourselves. That's absolutely false. The entire created cosmos, the entire physical universe. Think about this. I mean, I don't even, what's the name of the telescope they have now? Not the Hubble, but the latest one, the one that, what is it?
Web.
Yeah, the Webb. The Webb telescope. You know, they've, you know, picked up on waves that they think came from the original Big Bang, and I don't know even how many trillions of light years of images that they've managed to pick up with using these two totally powerful telescopes and knowing how to analyze it. And all of that was created in a process that took billions of years, as Carl Sagan loves to say, billions and billions of, you know, whatever his billions of things were, but all of that was created with a mind to us, which is pretty incredible. You think about God, the extravagance of his gift to us, the intricacy, you know, down to the subatomic realm, and the majesty up to the however big the physical universe is, and the expanse of time, and how chronologically, and even more so, I would say, in terms of physical space that we occupy, we're just a blip, you know, like less than a speck of dust. And God did that all for us. And he created, in a certain sense, you can say the galaxy or the universe is our playground. It's kind of like this gigantic oversized sandbox that you get to explore, and God is saying, well, go to it. But you know what? I'm going to kind of read through the readings, and then I'll get more to my points again. The second reading from Genesis, which is the second creation account, which interestingly enough seems to be the one that whoever wrote first, the sacred writer wrote first. So Genesis 2 actually was written before Genesis 1, for what is worth. Genesis 1 is kind of more of a step-by-step, this is how God made everything. Like I said, it's kind of a quasi-scientific approach to it. Genesis 2 is much more relational, which I think is why it tends to be more useful for us in our meditations a lot of the time. Genesis 2 just says, the Lord God took the man and settled him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate and to care for it. We're going to look at those words later. Interestingly enough, though, the word cultivate is cultivate the garden, tend the garden. You think, what does that imply? Well, it implies that you are taking care of something, also that you're perfecting it, right? You are sharing in God's creative process. God is giving you a share in his dominion, so to speak, over creation. He says, you're free to eat of any of the trees of the garden except the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We'll get to that later. And then God says, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper suited to him. So God formed out of the ground the wild animals and the birds of the air, and he brought them to the man so that to see what he would call them. Okay, this is another stage, example of God giving Adam authority. In the Bible, and in God's mind, names have a lot of weight to them. a name almost points to like the essence of a thing. And that's why when you're doing an exorcism, for example, there's a stage where the exorcist compels the demon, tell me your name. And the demon always fights that one tooth and nail. It's a sign that the exorcist, it's really not the exorcist, it's the church, because everything that the exorcist is doing, it's a liturgical prayer, which means you're bringing to bear the full weight of the church as church in this moment of prayer. It's a sign that the church is overcoming the demon. And what happens is when the demon gives you the name, then you have gained a new stage of authority over him. And something similar is happening here. The Lord brings all these animals to Adam and he gets to name them. Sure, okay, you're a cow, you're an ox, or whatever. But more than that, he's giving him authority. And it's like Adam is kind of putting each thing in its place according to his vision of things. And God is giving him that power. He gave the names to all the tame animals, the birds of the air, and none proved to be a suitable helper. So God built the rib he had taken from the man into a woman. When he brought her to the man, he said, "This one at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called woman, for out of man this one has been taken." So God has brought all these animals and things to Adam. Nothing seems to, you know, knock his socks off. He creates Adam, and as Jeff Cavins, the Bible scholar, says, at that moment, Adam said those famous Hebrew words, "Ooh la la." whatever that expresses, it's an emotional expression. Because Eve had been built from Adam. So I'm going to get into something here that's a little bit sensitive. Eventually, this is all going to kind of tie together. Right now, we've got a bunch of loose ends. It's interesting that Adam was creative just as Adam, right? Now, Adam was nonetheless incomplete. We were not made to be like in our individual silos. We were made, part of the fact that we're made in the image and likeness of God is the fact that we are made in community. Angels, interestingly enough, each one is their own species. So in each angel, you can say broadly there's a species of pure spirit, and okay, in that sense, yes. But each angel is a distinct species from every other angel. With humanity, it's not that way. There's a philosophical reason behind that. It's the material component. But we form all together one species, and we are individuals of one species. But we are incomplete just as men. And like God made Adam in his image and likeness, but it wasn't completely in God's image and likeness. Why? Because in the end of the day, God is a trinity. He is a trinity of relations. You could even go so far as to say, therefore, God is a family. And God, when he made us, he made Adam, and he says there's still something missing. And of course, God knew that, but he allowed Adam to kind of go through the experience of, well, everything is great, but there's something I can't put my finger on it. There's just something that's not right. There's something that's just... until he brings Eve, and Eve becomes a pure gift to Adam. And in that sense, you can say, now I don't want this to be misunderstood, especially because I'm being recorded, but I don't want this to be misunderstood that Eve is somehow subjected to, or that there's a distinction of dignity or anything. But you could say Eve was created in function of Adam. And you can even see in the sense of what is their work. Adam was created and God says, till the garden. Actually, the word till, I didn't get into that earlier, but it's the same word that is used in Hebrew liturgy for the priestly function. The priest tills whatever he's tilling in his duties. So Hebrew is kind of being a primitive language. A lot of times one word means so many different things. So Adam is actually not only working creation and perfecting it and exploring it and doing all these things. He's also in his function of cultivating and tilling. Cultivating was actually the word. He is actually the priest for the world. So Adam's focus, though, is always out. He's kind of, I have a mission. I've been stuck in this place, and I have a mission. And to this day, as men, that's the way we're wired. We build society. We build bridges. We build businesses. We go out and do stuff. Eve was created in function of him. And she was created to complement him. She was created to co-missioned with him. The word used here in English is a helpmate, which sounds like, okay, sidekick, you know, helper. That's not at all the case. What it really means is she was created to have the same, or to cooperate with Adam in his mission and to bring, you know, the things that she brings that are different than the things he brings, to complement him in the mission that Adam has received. But she is created in function of Adam. I made the argument with the women last weekend. You could, I mean, probably some theologian could correct me, but my argument was that Eve was the most beautiful thing that God ever made, at least in terms of humanity or physical creation. And part of that beauty is the fact that she was not just stuck in the garden, but she was oriented towards a person, and that there's a beauty in that. And you notice, again, the way that we're wired. Men are much more receptive to, even physically, the beauty of the woman, right? And women are much more inclined to worry about what the guy is thinking about her, or, you know, what impression she is making. Guys, how do we want to make our impression? By and large, is by what do we do? Who kind of, what do we accomplish? You know, what are my qualities? What is my capacity to affect change, to do things in a good way? I mean, there's nothing wrong per se with that. In women, by and large, there's going to be a greater tendency to find their security in, am I beautiful? Am I appreciated? Am I desired? Am I desirable? And it's that's part of the intercomplementarity of us. What that also means, though, is that Adam, as a man from the very beginning, he has an authority over Eve. It's not authority in the sense of, well, I don't want to use the word dominion falsely. There is a dominion, but it's not in a possessive way or an abusive way by any means. But it means that they work together, but she looks to him. So looking at these different creation accounts, we see, first of all, there's a clear hierarchy. God rules... this is something that jumped out at me, and I didn't really specify this. When we're looking at creation, going back to the Genesis chapter 1, it's interesting. God says... So God speaks, let us make human beings in our image and likeness. He creates us. And God gives commands to us. What are the commands he gives to us? He says, be fertile and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. So again, I want you to multiply and then subdue. Those are God's two commands. So for again, right from the very beginning, that dominion is part of our nature. What's established there is right off the bat is a hierarchy then. God is at the top. He tells Adam what to do. Adam has no bones about it. He understands completely, you created me, and thank you for creating me, and he's very grateful and all that, so it's not like he feels God is some sort of a tyrant. But it's very clear right from the very beginning, you're above me, I do what you say. The same structure applies naturally to families. Kids naturally, I mean, they may back, you know, have their temper tantrums and all those moments when they don't obey, but that's when they clearly also know that they're behaving the way they shouldn't. But kids by nature know that somehow or other, mom and dad made me, without getting too much into the specifics, it may be fuzzy for them, but they know that mom and dad made me somehow, and that I'm supposed to obey them. It's just in the way that we're wired, right? And they're little kids, and they follow around mom and dad because they're always bigger and smarter, and they always know what's best and all that. Same thing with God and Adam. But that Adam, in turn, from the very beginning, rules over everything else that God made. So there's a hierarchy. It's God, us, everything else. And then when God creates Eve, it's still us because there's two of them. But from the beginning, it's clear in his creation process that, again, Eve looks to Adam. He's kind of the alpha in that sense. Now, this is where things get a little interesting, and this is not going to be stuff that's explicitly drawn out of the Bible text. One of the things that we tend to forget about is when God created Adam and Eve, and he created them perfectly harmoniously, where they were absolutely flawlessly without sin, and all of their faculties perfectly obeyed and were perfectly aligned with, ultimately, their intellect, which was aligned with God. So their will served their intellect, which was completely infused with God's light and enlightened by him, so it was geared towards knowing what he wanted them to do, knowing him, and their will loved God absolutely, and therefore that led everything else, all of their other faculties were in subjection to their will. Their emotions were perfectly harmonious. They didn't have weird cravings. You know, like me, there are certain times of day just irrationally I have to go get chocolate or something. Adam and Eve didn't deal with that. They weren't addicted to caffeine. They didn't fly off the handle for no reason. They didn't have all these quirks that we tend to deal with regularly. Everything was perfectly balanced in them. Now, one of the effects of that is they had what are referred to as preternatural gifts. So when we talk in existence, there is nature. Nature doesn't just mean pine trees and squirrels and things like that, but nature, when we talk about what is natural, we refer to it is when a thing behaves the way that it's programmed to from its very essence. So for example, the nature of wood is to be hard but slightly yielding, and to have nice aroma and whatnot. The nature of dogs is to act like dogs, and the nature of cats is to act like cats. The only physical creature that has a choice to disobey its own nature is us, because we have free will, we have intellect. Okay, everything else, by its nature, does the thing. Even if it's inanimate, like this stand, it still performs according to the nature of what it is meant to be. If this thing got up and started hopping around, you would freak out because it's not in its nature, right? It's a stand. And then there is supernatural. Supernatural is not all the weird things that we tend to think of. Supernatural, ultimately, in philosophical and theological language, just means that which pertains to God. God is above nature. So when you and I act in faith, hope, and charity, theological faith, theological hope, and theological charity, we're acting supernaturally. Why? Because it's God is, in a certain sense, supercharging us and enabling us to do things that on a natural level we can't. Now, the interesting thing is our nature was made by God for supernatural grace. We're incomplete if we don't have his grace in us. But that's, for example, if you want to see extreme examples of that, think of the martyrs. How can you have enough faith, hope, and love to be willing to give your life, and not just give your life for your wife or your child or something that might be understandable, but to give your life for your enemy, to offer up your life for the person who is persecuting you or the ones that you love? That, humanly speaking, is absolutely impossible except for the grace of God. That it would be something that is supernatural, that is not natural. So preternatural is right in the middle. Preternatural would mean a higher nature. And preternatural is when you see all the exorcism movies, for example. Okay, well, what do demons do? They do preternatural stuff. They have a higher nature. They have a dominion over physical creation, so they can make, if God allows them, everything is always under God's perfect providence. But he can allow them to do all kinds of crazy things, walk up walls and do things, levitate and supernatural acts of strength and whatnot. Well, not all preternatural things are bad. You and I, Adam and Eve, were endowed with a whole packet of preternatural capacities that we don't even hardly know about, but they were there. because of the way that they were made, that perfect human creation. First of all, they had their intellect was absolutely fluid and sharp and concise and everything. And they had knowledge of things. I don't know exactly what form, but they had their natural capacity to figure things out, and then they also had preternatural knowledge, which was just the capacity to intuitively pick up on things without taking the time to stop and think and figure it out like you and I regularly do. You know, angelic knowledge is, for example, it is 100% intuitive. They see something, they either get it or they don't. But there's no rational thinking it out process. Angelic knowledge, pure God's knowledge is like that too. Pure spirit is just, in philosophical terms, you'd say they see a form and they grasp the form and they take it in and they get it. And Adam and Eve had a lot of that. They would have had probably the capacity to work what we would consider miracles. I don't know exactly what they are, but think, for example, of Christ after the resurrection. He did things, you unfair advantage, he's God, okay, I get it. He can do things because he's God also, and God can just choose to give him the capacity. But Christ did things. He showed a physical, just a total ease, but a dominion over nature. You know, just going to walk through a wall, I'll walk through a wall, no problem. I suspect to a certain extent Adam and Eve had those things. They could call on those things that need be. That's part of having dominion over nature. You think about some of the miracles that saints perform. Okay, obviously everything in the end of the day comes from God, because it's not natural. If it was natural, that would be God gave us a nature to, like, I can pick up a hammer, and because it's in my nature, fine. So all of these things come from God, but they, because of the way that the harmony and the kind of existence they had, they would have had these preternatural gifts constantly happening. Now, I am currently studying, I'm kind of in a healing ministry class. I don't know if you've heard of the Encounter Ministries. Right now, there are different groups out there. There's Bob Schutz, and he's got the John Paul II Healing Center. Bob Schutz was a psychologist, and he kind of went to a charismatic retreat and had some experience, and I don't recall what exactly it was. And a lot of our preaching anymore, you'll hear, will pick up on things like from Bob Schutz, talking about going back and finding your wounds and your woundedness and the fruit, the tree and the different fruits and the manifestations, things like that. And because a lot of the times when you try to figure out why do I have something so deeply ingrained, there will tend to have been something in the past that left a wound, and we tend to protect ourselves from that in a bad way, in a false way, that closes us from God's grace. And that's where our woundedness comes from. Well, I'm in the Encounter Ministries, which is also kind of catching on. And even in the Anáhuac University, run by the Legionaries of Christ, they had some class from the Encounter. And it's kind of a charismatic-based, somewhat ecumenical thing. But there's some interesting things happening. And one of our priests in Detroit, Father Jason Brooks, is actually on the Encounter Ministries team now. And it is basically, there's no quote-unquote technique to healing because it always comes from God, right? But there are mentalities that you can form and things that you can understand that will open up the door to God using you as an instrument to heal, right? And that's, again, we're talking about the fact that God has given us authority. Well, you and I have authority that we don't even realize we have in the church. I don't want to go, this is not the main point of the meditation, but it's an example. When Christ gave the church indications early on, he said, and he repeated this, it wasn't just to the 12, he repeated that actually to all the disciples. They would go out at different moments, he would say things like, go out and proclaim the gospel as you go, and if you find any sick, heal them. And if you, somebody, I think even in one occasion says, raise the dead and cast out demons. Through our baptism, we all have the capacity. Again, God is always free and sovereign. So in any given moment, he is the one who chooses. But we have the capacity, every single person, by baptism, to be an instrument of healing, and even for deliverance ministry, to be casting out demons. That doesn't take away from the fact that there's a difference between deliverance, for example, and exorcism, and there are people that the church calls upon to be specially chosen to be exorcists. It doesn't also take away from the fact that there are certain people that have received what we call charisms that are at a different level. So there are different levels to this thing. But we have that authority. And it happens. Well, I've seen lay people. Actually, I haven't seen anything that couldn't technically just be, maybe our imagination or whatnot. But I know people that have seen, like Father Jason Brooks, over the phone, prayed with a lady who had stage 4 cancer. She only had a couple weeks, theoretically, to live. And over the phone, prayed with her and gave her 100% cure. That happened within the last year or so. I have yet to have such an experience or even witness such an experience. But, people that I know and trust have had them. So what I'm getting to, though, is the fact that you and I have authority that we need to, in a sense, rediscover what that means. And that's part of the fact that we're created in the image and likeness of God. Okay, this is a related topic again, authority in terms of spiritual combat. Because this is actually important for you as men. Maybe you'll feel like I don't feel inclined or called to go out and, pray over somebody and ask God to heal them. It takes a lot of gumption at the beginning especially, but here's something that does touch upon all of your lives. It won't sound like it at first. Demons understand authority perfectly well. And they know exactly if you have authority in some matter or not. And if you don't, they will thumb their nose at you and they couldn't care less. And if you do have authority and you claim it, they are forced to recognize it and obey because they know that, okay. And what am I talking about? Well, where do you have authority? The moment you get married, you and your wife contract authority over one another's bodies, so to speak, because you gain rights to basically the marital union. Part of it takes place in the flesh, right? The two become one flesh. In a broader sense, you would say that means they become one person because it's clearly geared towards the spiritual union that takes place. And when you get married, when I talk to engaged couples, the way I say is, look, up until now you have, your goal has been, how can I be a saint as an individual? Now that you're going to be married, you will be working to become saints as a couple together. The two will become one, and your goal will be helping each other mutually get to heaven. So, but when you enter into marriage, there is a kind of authority that each of you gain over one another. And what that means, for example, is your prayers for one another are more powerful than, if Gary prays for your wife, it's nice. If you pray for your wife, because of the authority that you have contracted in that matrimonial bond, it has an extra power. There's a multiplier effect there. Okay. And the same is true to a greater extent with our children. Your children, by the very fact of being your children, you have, in the spiritual realm, you have an authority over them, which means your prayers for your children have a greater efficacy than anybody else's prayers for your children. Now, I don't want to get too mathematical about it and say it's a multiplier of 1.3 times or whatever. Is it true that probably the prayer of a Mother Teresa of Calcutta, I'm sure, if she prays for your children, that it will be probably more efficacious than your prayers, no matter what relationship she has with them and whether or not she's ever heard of them? I'm sure that's true. I'm sure, the holiness of the individual is still going to be probably the most essential element, right? But it's also true that there are these lines of authority that God creates, and we need to lean into those. For example, in Latino culture, it's not uncommon, maybe so much, especially with like the poor, simpler people who in this case are much wiser. When the kids leave the house, the parents will give a blessing. You have the power to do that. And it has a lot of weight. And if you regularly are blessing your kids, you know, when they leave, when they come home, or when they undertake something, or before they go to bed, that has a lot of power. The same way that if you happen to live with a priest and he was doing it, it would have a lot of power of regularly blessing, you know. Again, if you're going around blessing somebody else's kids, it might not have so much effect because you do not have that, the structure of authority is not there. And that's something that in the spiritual realm, the demons are forced to recognize, and they're forced to respect it when we claim it. So as men, as spouses, as fathers, part of the way that God created us is that we have authority in the area that pertains to our mission. And your first mission is going to be your immediate family, right? Yourself and your immediate family. And then next circle out will be society at large. You know, maybe if you want to break it down, my neighborhood, okay, fine. And then society at large. So to the extent that, you know, this is your primary mission, that's the closer something is to your primary mission, the greater the spiritual authority God, excuse me, has given to you. Think about this. God gave Adam and Eve, this is a kind of a caveat to everything I'm saying, and this is, I think, part of the reason why the world is messed up. God gave Adam and Eve this mission. He said, go out, multiply, be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth. Here's the problem. Can you subdue the earth when you cannot first subdue yourself? Very difficult. You can do certain things. You can have tyranny over the earth, and you can force the earth to produce certain products that you want it to. But in the broader sense, can you truly subdue the earth the way God wants if you cannot subdue yourself? That was the problem of the original sin. In the beginning, they could. There was the perfect harmony to everything Adam and Eve did and everything that they were. And so it was co-natural to them from the very essence of their being to have this kind of dominion over the earth. You and I are children of Adam and Eve, of the fallen version. So this is why the stuff I'm saying sounds a little bit weird, or it sounds like, really, or I'm not so sure about it, or whatever, because it's not, doesn't feel co-natural to us because we're busted. And the more that we, through the growth of the life of grace, sanctifying grace in our hearts, the growth of holiness ultimately, the holier we get and the more that we become in tune with God in our lives, and we become more, all of our faculties become aligned with the will of God and with the grace of God, the more co-natural all of this will be to us. And that's why, again, you see saints don't seem to have any problem with just the fact that miracles happen around them. You know, one of my examples that I like is St. John Vianney. He had this little school for girls, and he wanted to teach them to be good Christian girls and, you know, just good Christian women. And I think it was actually kind of an orphanage set up because there's just a little bit of flower there. And he said, well, you know, there's like 100 girls and there's just this little bit of flour. Well, bake some bread. Yeah, but there's not enough. Well, bake it and see how much you can get out of it. You know, doing something is better than doing nothing, right? So they start baking it. They start mixing the dough, and the lady takes, okay, a little bit of flour and puts in water. And it's like, well, it still needs more water. And this dough just keeps growing and growing until there's this massive dough miraculously that, because she has to keep putting in water because it was still too dry the whole time. And it just, and she goes back to St. John Vianney and tells him, Father, there was a miracle here, and, that little amount of flour multiplied, and we had enough to make for the kids and then some. And he was just like completely nonchalant. Praise be to God. to him, it was the most normal thing. It's like, that's the way life is supposed to work. So I think to the extent that we grow in our spiritual lives, we will also grow in our understanding of the authority that God has given. Okay, over, in a sense, the different realms that we mentioned is going to be over physical material itself. And for example, one example would be things like healing. The authority that we have within our families and the authority that we have over the demonic in the areas that pertain to the realm of our authority. And as men, we are called to exercise that authority in the world.